This is the Motorcycle Mentor Podcast with David Mixon, session number 15.
Welcome to the Motorcycle Mentor Podcast, where it's all about helping beginner riders, just like his motorcycle mentor helped him. And now your host, who dreams of someday having a blueberry orchard, David Mixon.
Hey everybody, this is David Mixon. Thanks for listening to the Motorcycle Mentor Podcast. Today I'm going to play part two of my three-part interview with Ed Becker. Ed is the executive director of the Snell Memorial Foundation, you know, the organization that tests and certifies motorcycle helmets. If you haven't listened to part one of my interview with Ed, I really recommend that you do that first. That's on podcast number 14. You can also find a link to that interview, along with additional resources, including a transcript of the entire interview, a video of the log splitter that I mentioned on podcast number 14 of them crushing tested motorcycle helmets, and links to part one and two and three of this interview. You can find that on the show notes page. It's at motorcyclementor.com/Snell. If you'd like to be a part of the motorcyclementor.com community, the best way to do that is to sign up for our email newsletter. This is the best way I can reach out and get your questions for future guests or notify you about happenings on the MotorcycleMentor.com website or about the Motorcycle Mentor podcast. To do this, put your first name and email address in the right column of the MotorcycleMentor.com website, or if you're on a smartphone, sometimes it's at the bottom of the articles. Don't worry, I hate spam too. Every email I send is actually through a professional service, and there's an unsubscribe button. So if your interests change, you sell your motorcycle, you can always unsubscribe from the email list. And I really don't email very often anyway. You can also join us on Facebook, and you can find out how to do that on the website, motorcyclementor.com. You'll see Join Us on Facebook. Here's part two of my conversation with Ed Becker. Take us through the process. Let's say a helmet manufacturer wants Snell to certify and test, we'll call it Helmet X. Now, how do they go about doing this? You know, how long does it take? What's the process look like? How many helmets do they submit you? Just kind of step us through that.
Yeah. A new manufacturer, one we've never heard of, comes up with a helmet and wants to get into the program. Ask him to send us a set of samples. It's either five or seven samples for a given helmet configuration, depending on the range of head sizes it's supposed to accommodate. And he'll also send us a pre-test information sheet. It's really just a form filled out with manufacturer information, the description of the helmet, and, very important description of exactly what he wants done. We get lots of helmets in here, and it can get very confusing without some kind of form to guide us through the requested service. We can get those helmets tested within a week to 10 days. And we'll get results out by email, as well as by formal letter to the manufacturer submitted the helmets. If the helmets pass, for a new manufacturer, we'll invite him to enter into the standard licensing agreement. It's a contract between Snell and the manufacturer that lays out just what the manufacturer's rights are and obligations, and the same for us. Standard licensing agreement is the document, really, that details the enforcement program that the manufacturer has to submit to. And it also spells out just what his rights are in using the Snell name from that point on to market his certified helmets. Once that's executed, we're ready to start normal business. We'll suspend the obligation to prepay for services and start to issue certification labels for the manufacturer to put inside his helmets, and also invoices for testing services and the acquisition and testing of the enforcement helmets and all of that. But for a manufacturer that's been in the program, it's even simpler. All he does is send us the helmets and the pretest information sheet. And within a week or 10 days, we're generally able to get testing results back to him and notification, anyway, of whether the helmets are going to be included in the program or not.
Do you save any samples for later testing or archiving purposes?
Definitely. We keep a copy of every helmet that has gone through the certification program. The manufacturer submits samples. We'll generally test all but one of them. And that one, if the helmet meets requirements, is stored for comparison to helmets that come in later on for enforcement testing. And if there's any question at all, we'll get the helmets out and compare them and maybe get back to the manufacturer with a query on just what's going on.
What do you do with the helmets that you've tested?
When we test a helmet, the testing is destructive. We certainly don't want anybody mistaking that helmet for head protection ever again. We have a log splitter that will run tested helmets through, unless the manufacturer actually requests them to be returned to him for his research and analysis. The log splitter puts a big split in the back of the helmet. It certainly keeps our neighbors out here in California from dumpster diving looking for headgear.
That would be interesting. Do you have any pictures or video of that?
No, but certainly I can get some.
That would be interesting. I'd love to put that. Be an interesting sight to see.
Well, kind of heartbreaking. Yeah. Run some expensive helmets through that log splitter.
I bet.
Yeah.
How do you, you talked a little bit about this, but how do you ensure that the models that pass initial Snell certification continue to meet your standard after they've been tested, like years later? I mean, how do you ensure that?
We'll go out and buy samples of helmets that are available in shops, or from dealers and distributors, and bring them in. So we want to be sure we're getting the exact same helmets that people are actually buying and wearing. We'll bring those into the lab here and test them. If there's any question at all, we do another series of tests where we'll go out and get three more from the same source and test those. If those follow-up tests confirm the original failure, then we'll demand that the manufacturer stop production immediately, and we'll send the results up to our board of directors, and they will make the determination whether to demand a recall.
Does that happen very often?
No, it does not. Thank God. We do stop production regularly, but the deviations that we see are usually very slight. The recall is kind of a nuclear bomb.
I bet.
And it will poison, I think, the manufacturer's chances in the market for years later. So it's something that the directors are very careful about requiring. They do not want to create any unnecessary panic over what's considered a slight deviation. But still, they want the manufacturer to stop production, correct it, and then resubmit the certification testing.
Let's talk about testing standards. What are testing standards and how do you use them?
Standards, I was describing them as a kind of a yardstick, something that you can hold up to an object for an objective measurement, evaluation. and they turn up all over industry, all over, I think, modern life. They got standards for plumbing supplies, standards for automobile components, standards for just about any kind of food you see in the supermarkets. Purpose is to assure that there's continuing quality in the of the goods, and that's the way we use them. We look at performance standards here. We're not interested in, so much in what an object is as we are in what it does. And all our standards are test standards, and generally call for destructive testing. It's about the only way to really evaluate what's going on with a motorcycle home. The standards that we have, we look for tests and requirements that are objective, that are reliable, will give us the same results just about every time, and that are provide a reasonable assessment of what the helmet will actually do to somebody in the field. All of that's important. We don't want anything arbitrary or unnecessary clouding our judgment.
How often do the standards change?
We revise standards these days on a 5-year cycle. So it was a Snell M2000, then an M2005. At this point, the M2015 is in the works. When Snively started out, though, he revised them much more frequently. At the beginning, he was working with practically a clean slate, and he was really trying to drag the helmet industry into toward what was technically feasible at the time. So he had revised his standards just about every time the industry began to catch up with what the very best in the industry could do. There were several revisions in the 1960s, and it wasn't really to the mid-70s that Snively had managed to drag the industry toward what the limits of the technology were at the time. Helmets got a whole lot bigger in the intervening years, and the demands of his tests increased dramatically, and practically a very steep ascent between 1959 and 1975. And since then, it's been much more gradual. The fact is that technology is getting kind of mature. There's not a whole lot more that can be wrung out of what current helmet configurations can do without a big, really breakthrough in materials technology, engineering, or in the understanding, really, of human tolerance to head impact.
What is the difference between the M2015 and the M2010?
There's hardly any difference at all. We've tightened up some of the test procedures, but the helmets themselves are really not going to change. My advice to anyone with a M2010 helmet in good condition is that when M2015 takes effect, they do not need to go running out to buy a new helmet. Actually, I've missed the last several standard revisions. The improvements are there, but they're slight. It's just a mild upward gradient, and there's no reason for panic at all.
How can somebody look at their Snell certified helmet and tell which standard was used?
The best way for any question about a Snell helmet is to look for the Snell certification label. It's inside the helmet, generally under the comfort padding and up against the inner surface of that thick EPS liner. The sticker is kind of a chocolate brown. It's 3.5 inches by about 3/4 inch, rectangular. There's standard, the Snell standard and year in big white letters on it, and then it's all overprinted with warnings, including that warning that there are reasonably foreseeable accidents that will exceed that helmet's capability to protect against death or severe injury, and also a unique Snell serial number. If there's a ever a question at all about the provenance of that helmet, drop me an email or give us a call and let us know what the serial number is. We can check that serial number to confirm the correct manufacturer and manufacturing date.
That's great. Thank you for that. Why do standards change, and what is the process to change them?
We change the standards, really, because either we know something we didn't know when the previous standard was out, or the technology has improved to the point that we can afford to bump up the requirements. The process starts with a draft standard being circulated to the industry and really to anybody who wants to look. We'll request suggestions, comments, criticism. What it narrows down to finally is we're running kind of an auction where we want the best helmet that the industry can provide, and we will look to get the highest set of demands that a plausible manufacturer is willing to sign on to. So the very best in the industry, along with Snell's board of experts, really wind up narrowing down what the final standard is going to look like. And that's repeated every 5 years or so, in the hope that that maybe in the meantime manufacturers will have come across some new material or design technique that's going to allow them to wring a little more impact management out of the current materials, or that the directors maybe have learned something new about human tolerance to injury and want that incorporated into the requirements.
When will you start working on the standard 2020?
Probably get serious at least about it beginning in 2017, 2018, and start circulating standards. The process for N2010 was especially arduous. We started out really in 2006. Shortly after 2005 took effect, there we were working from data that one of our directors provided, showing that really we'd be much better off using the graduated mass head forms. Up to that point, we and even BSI in Europe had been using a 5-kilogram head form, no matter what the head size was. But Dr. Ching up at the University of Washington had very convincing data that, as a matter of fact, the helmets, heads anyway, human heads, follow the cube. That, kind of like cheese, the head weight increased as the head circumference cube increased. The changeover to these graduated mass head forms was, I think, real trying for the industry. It certainly was a big effort for us as well. But now that everyone's caught their breath, I think they're ready to proceed into N2015 and SA2015 for auto racing helmets as well.
Does Snell influence DOT and ECE standards?
Not really. DOT finalized, put out their first standard really in 1974, and it's hardly changed at all, you know, except for a few revisions to include different size headphones and the like. They haven't done anything. The requirements have stayed the same. In fact, the requirements really are what Dr. Snively was looking for in 1966. It was a good standard in 1966, but certainly there's a lot of room for improvement these days. EC came about when the European Economic Union was formed, and they really swept away all the local national standards because they considered them in restraint of trade. The result is that I think EC 2205 is a kind of a lowest common denominator standard for all the countries in Europe. It's certainly a disappointment. It's swept out BSI 6658, the English standard that had held sway in England since 1985, and which was really the toughest of all the mandatory national standards at that point.
Let's talk about how helmets have changed over time. You've explained how testing standards have changed, but how have materials used in helmets changed?
The materials have hardly changed at all. They've done a few experiments with adding different fibers to the some of the fiberglass shells, but for the most part, the shell and impact managing liner, the real workhorses of impact protection, have remained very much the same. The improvements have been instead the shells have gotten thicker, more rigid, and heavier a little bit, and the impact liners, that EPS material, has gotten thicker as well. Went from 25 millimeters or so on average back in the days of the Hurt Report up to maybe 35, and for many snow helmets, even more than that these days. But that EPS and shell technology has been around since really the 1950s. EPS was first patented as a material for use in head protection devices. The changes have been rather that instead of switching to new materials, they're taking the old, same old material, making them thicker, stronger, and capable of managing more impact energy just because of that additional thickness and strength.
Let's say somebody has four never worn before helmets, and they're inside, so it's climate controlled, humidity controlled. One is new, one is 5 years old, one is 10 years old, and the last one is 20 years old. Okay. How would you compare these four helmets? You know, what have you seen in the design changes in the last 20 years, and which ones would you feel comfortable recommending?
At this point, a 20-year-old helmet would take us back to Snell M95, which is really pretty good. There's not that much difference in the helmets that were made then versus what's made now. Biggest problem might be that you'll find that no matter how carefully you stored the helmet, that the comfort lining, soft foam padding, would have deteriorated somewhat, and maybe the chin bar would have gotten a little tough, and the chin strap rather would have gotten a little tough and scratchy. But the impact protection, the shell, and the EPS liner would probably be as good as the day you put the helmet up. Dr. Snively and his colleagues actually took a bunch of brand new helmets in the 70s and put them out on a garage roof in the Sierras, left them there for years. And periodically, they would go and retrieve a few, bring them into the lab and test them. This is over a period of years, they found that the impact protection, at least as nearly as they could test it, didn't change at all. But problem with helmets would be the wear and tear they get from daily use. One of the problems with EPS is it lasts forever. It's filling up landfills and nobody knows quite what to do with it. But for helmets, hardly beat it. So I would not hesitate to, or at least I wouldn't criticize anybody for wearing a new helmet, a helmet in new condition from even 20 years ago. The problem would be just how well you trusted the people that put it up and stored it for those 20 years. There's a whole lot of things that can happen to the helmet that that you won't be able to see or evaluate by eyeball, but that will take that helmet down. One of the biggest concerns I've seen is that motorcycle helmets usually are frequently in places where there's gasoline and solvents for cleaning engines and parts around. And those solvents or gasoline will attack the EPS, and usually in such a way that nobody knows that gasoline has eaten away the protection of the helmet until somebody actually needs it in the crash. Disassembled helmets here that have been around gasoline spills and seen the inner liner be chewed up in the area between the liner and shell so that it would be completely invisible until the helmet was disassembled.
Wow.
Big problem.
Does gasoline react with the EPS similar to how it reacts with styrofoam?
Styrofoam is EPS.
Okay. Because yep. It's if you've never seen that, it just melts it. So.
Oh, yeah. I've seen guys try to move small amounts of gasoline from one part, right. One place to another.
Yes, and that's a shocking experience as a child.
There's nothing there.
Wow, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
So there you have it, part two of my interview with Ed Becker, Executive Director of the Snell Memorial Foundation. I'll post additional resources, including the log splitter video, transcript for the entire interview, and links to all three parts of my interview with Ed on the show notes page. That's at motorcyclementor.com/Snell. And the /is actually where the question mark is. Just type that in your toolbar and you'll go straight to this page. Ed, thanks again for speaking with me. When Ed told me he was available for 2 hours, we both talked about it and figured that we'd maybe talk for an hour and a half and get maybe 25 minutes of good content. Well, I couldn't find what to cut out, so that's why I split it up into three podcasts. It was just solid information for the entire hour and a half, so that was really incredible. In part three of my interview with Ed, Ed explains Snell's testing fees. He also discusses what test causes the most certification failures or problems. We talk about helmet maintenance, how often you should replace your helmet, and he answers the question, should you replace your helmet if you drop it? And he answers questions in the Motorcycle Mentor Lightning Round. You really don't want to miss part three. If you enjoyed the podcast, would you share it on Facebook or Twitter, your favorite forum? Thanks in advance for doing this. It really helps. And also, if you haven't yet rated the podcast on iTunes or Podbay or Stitcher, please do that. And email if you do. I'd like to personally thank you on the show for doing that. So until next time, this is David Mixon, challenging you to think before you ride.
Thanks for listening to the Motorcycle Mentor Podcast at motorcyclementor.com.